Do not want to breathe on you. This is just.
This is Mame Warren. Today is May 12th, 1999. I'm in Lexington, Virginia, once again with my good friend Jefferson Davis Futch III, who is snuffling with a cold.
There will be many sound effects.
But we will get around that. Now, you are a Hopkins man.
Indeed, twice over.
But I want to go back even before that, because you grew up in Baltimore.
Prehistory, yes.
So tell me about growing up in Baltimore, what neighborhood you lived in, and what your perspective was about Hopkins as you grew up.
Well, the neighborhood is called Windsor Hills, and the houses are still there, 80-some years old now. And it was very sort of middle class, not grand like Homeland and Guilford, but not like Wilkins Avenue either. Big yards, big houses, big trees, lots of space, and it was an idyllic upbringing. And one of the many ways in which my life differed from that of other youngsters was that I never gave any thought to college, hardly any, in junior and senior high school, public schools all the way, the whole 12 years of public schools. And I simply thought that colleges were for great brains. Now that I'm a teacher, I see that that brains are needed for neither teaching nor being a student. But I simply regarded colleges and universities as being in the stratosphere. And most of the family members had never been to college, because it was a very elitist country at one time in the early part of the century, and very few people had been to college, proportionally speaking, until after World War II. And so I never gave any serious thought to college. And in high school, there was a weird lady who taught something, what was it, civics or something like that, who was a PhD. And she was the one who caused my mind to become focused on a PhD. And she was repulsive in every way, but was the first PhD I had ever met. And just as kids become fixated on guns or trench coats or Nazi emblems, I became fixated on the doctorate of philosophy. But of course, that was rather well beyond the undergrad years. I sort of wanted to get a PhD degree without bothering with college, because I was a very arrogant young man. And I remember telling my father on the eve of the Korean War, which nobody knew was coming, and when he brought up the subject of college, that I already knew everything I would ever need to know, and that I didn't want to bother with college, and I wanted to work for the Baltimore Sun. In those days, there was an evening edition, the Evening Sun, as a copy reader. Not that my command of style was as great as my command of grammar, but I didn't want to bother with college. And my father said, "You absolutely are going to go to college, and it's only a question of where." And I said, "Well, it won't be away from home," because I thought I was too young and innocent to leave home. So it turned out there were two, by happy circumstance, there were two excellent schools in Hopkins and Loyola in Baltimore. And given his insistence and refusal to consider anything except my going to college, I acquiesced. And he really engineered everything and got the application forms. I was bored out of my mind by the whole subject of applying for college. What would today be a complication, the SATs, didn't even come up, because if a kid had good high school grades, then the principal would simply write a letter to the college or university admissions office, it was a prudent thing to have an alumnus of Hopkins to write a letter of recommendation. And one very nice gentleman, a friend of a cousin, lied through his teeth and, while knowing nothing about me, said, "This is a fine and upstanding young man," wrote me a very glowing personal letter. And a letter from the high school principal apparently was good. And I think SATs could be taken, but were optional at the time. So I never had to bother with that hassle. And today kids sweat and strain and carry on about. Bless you.
Sorry.
Bless you, kids. Okay. Kids make a big thing about SATs, and I don't know if I would have had the patience to plow through that. And so I was accepted, and the Korean War broke out, and I thought, hallelujah. The draft board will give a deferment, not a lifetime exemption, but a deferment to anybody who has been accepted by an accredited university, and Hopkins had no problem with accreditation. And so I was slated to go, and in 1951 started, and had very good luck with 3 out of the 4 courses with which I started, and very bad luck with economics. Not the worst luck. It was the next to the worst, and I decided at once that economics is like astrology or alchemy. It's just nonsense, an opinion I've never changed. It's preposterous. And so that little problem, considering the excellent grades elsewhere, did not cause any problems, and I graduated in 1955. But I did not look toward college as toward some temple whose golden doors I was eager to pass through. I regarded it as a hassle and ahead of time. And then, of course, once I was in there and the Korean War was underway, I thought, what a handy shelter this is. But what I was still thinking of the PhD, and one of my fantasies there was it would be great to check into hotels and write doctor before my name, and then years later discover that that is not done, that PhDs don't do that.
So Hopkins itself was not a particular goal of yours.
No.
It was almost a matter of flipping a coin between Loyola and Hopkins, or how did you choose Hopkins?
I think I knew that Hopkins was more prestigious. I was very spacey about this. Kids today are so fixated on, high schoolers are so fixated on colleges that I'm sure they could, if given a list of 17 colleges and universities, could probably tell which is the most and which is the least prestigious and go down the whole list of 17 in the proper order. But I never considered any other place except those two, and I knew in my bones that Hopkins was much more famous and prestigious than Loyola. But this was not the result of some great craving, because I was probably the most arrogant 12th grader ever, and I just thought, what is it that I don't know, aside from the natural sciences, which to study those would be like being tortured by the North Koreans. But in the subjects that I was interested in, I was very smug, and I felt I knew everything.
Okay, so 1951, you've been accepted to Hopkins.
And went and matriculated.
Tell me about arriving on campus as a freshman. Take me there.
I'll take you there. Back to those days of yesteryear, like the Lone Ranger. I was bored with everything and everybody whom I met, everything I saw and everybody whom I met. I do remember, I guess this can't go in the book, I do remember that there was a physical exam with the freshmen being in very small groups. The health building was a very tiny farmhouse that had once been, had been there obviously for 100 years already, when it was all farmland, long before any large human habitation was in that part of the area. And we were all standing around wearing boxers, I suppose, and an old gentleman walked in and just began eyeballing us, our crotches, and just staring, cruising. So I didn't know words like cruise, I knew a word like stare. And I thought, what is this? This is too bizarre. And then a day later, or maybe that afternoon, within a very short space of time, we were all dressed again, of course, and we were assembled in some room on campus for an orientation talk. And here was the same guy, the cruisy old gentleman, who was the dean of the college. And I thought, well, This says a lot because there was obviously no reason for the dean to come and look at all this anatomical smorgasbord. And so ever after, when I looked at the, when I would pass the dean in the years that followed, would pass him on the sidewalk, I would always nod and smile and think, you won't say, old wizard, you old devil. So there was that. Then there was a very boring man named Osmar P. Steinwald, after whom the alumni building, I think is named today, or the Steinwald House, either is or recently has been the name of the building. He was probably the biggest windbag and nobody that I had ever seen, and he gave some orientation talks, again, everyone fully clothed. And I thought, what a tired, uninspiring, tedious, pathetic, old leftover from bygone times this guy is. But he was the one who said something that I thought was terribly clever, and then I discovered in later years that every freshman class in every college in the country is told this. To the all-male entrant class, he said, I want each of you to look at the man on your left and the man on your right and realize that one of the three of you will have washed out, will have flunked out in the space of a year. And I thought, well, that's rather clever for such an old windbag. And then it turned out that it's been recycled thousands and thousands of times. And I was a little surprised years later to discover that this poor old wreck was memorialized by having his name on the alumni building. What else was there about the orientation? I've always been interested in architecture, and the architecture of Hopkins buildings is based. The style is based on Homewood House, and which I think was the wedding present of Charles Carroll, the signer of the Declaration of Independence, to his daughter or his son or somebody.
Son.
The son. Oh, you see, I'm batting 500 on that. And I paid very close attention to the architecture, and later on, when I had for distribution, I had to take a lot of art history, which I loved, of course. Then I was able to overdose on architecture, but the appearance of the buildings, and there are some covered walkways that lead from Gilman Hall to is it Remsen Hall next door to Gilman Hall, and on one side of the quadrangle, and then a similar brick and covered walkway to another building on the other side, the corresponding side of the quadrangle, and it was the architecture that I focused in on. The kids were nice but boring. The teachers whom I met seemed to be pleasant but boring. But then I thought of Korean Hilltops and the boring companions, both students and faculty, looked pretty good compared to the Chinese volunteers whom Mao Zedong sent south of the Yalu River. So I wasn't unhappy. I had no vision of what I wanted to do in life. So I wasn't in a hurry to practice medicine or teach college or practice law. I had no picture at all of the future. And it was a matter, to be at Hopkins was simply a matter of doing a job and in very pretty surroundings, nice landscaping, lovely buildings, refined students. The good relations among the students were not a pleasant surprise. Looking back, when we think of all the acrimony in high schools, in Colorado there's a particularly bad degree of acrimony. But the kids got along very, very well among themselves, and the professors didn't seem as aloof as the stereotype would have Hopkins professors. They were accessible enough and friendly enough, and I really had no complaints other than boredom. But there are worse things to put up with than boredom, I suppose.
Were there any faculty members who were particularly impressive to you?
Yes, yes. Oh, yes, several. There was one named David Spring, who may still be alive today. I'd be interested in knowing if he's still alive. He taught history. He was a specialist in Victorian England. But when I first encountered him, he was lecturing in a freshman survey course, starting with Neolithic. I hated Neolithic man and Paleolithic. I always hated cavemen in that period of history. But the course had it started with that, and then it went to the death of Louis XIV in 1715, all in one year, which was really a tour de force. Now I appreciate what he did. But he was a Canadian ex-communist who had become an ardent Burkean conservative. And he had acquired the mannerisms of a British duke, and I think not accidentally. He worshipped the British aristocracy, which for a former Marxist, as he was reputed to be, I will admit, he never told me he was a former communist, and students didn't begin conversations with professors. That would have seemed too audacious. Students here at WNL are much more inclined to bring up topics of conversation, but I would never have said, Dr. Spring, what is the truth of these stories that you were a communist in Canada in the 1930s? But at any rate, his sort of majestic, aristocratic air was very successfully cultivated, and I was awestricken by Professor Spring's regal way of talking. He had a terribly British accent, and he talked like that. And I've never met anybody this high and mighty. But he didn't put out unfriendly vibes, so I had nothing against him and was certainly impressed. Then, that was freshman year. Then there was, a year or two later, a Professor George Boas, whose name may, I'm sure, will ring quite a bell with people who are at Hopkins mm-hmm. today, Boas.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about him.
He and I were politically very, very much at odds, although, again, students were smart enough, I think, and timid enough, and respectful of authority enough not to engage in political conversations. So I winced when he took digs at conservatism in class. But leaving that aside, his wit and his sarcasm and the humorous turns of phrase that he had in an endless flow, his command of words, for, as you would expect for a philosophy teacher of that brilliance, was just astounding, especially to a youngster. And his lectures were almost pure joy for one sitting in class who liked little sly asides and sarcastic turns of phrase. And I have often thought at WNL that I have tried to model my lecture style on George Boas, while not emulating his political philosophy or embracing any aspect of that. And he, in some way, found out that I was to the right of Attila the Hun, not to mention Louis XIV, and he once jokingly, very good-naturedly, called me a young fogey. And I did not reply, as certain kids here today at WNL would reply, well, it takes an old fogey to spot a young fogey. So I tried to, I suppose I smiled and said, well, I plead guilty to that. So some bland and gentle answer to that. But he and I did not have political set-tos. However, the Republican Club was well known to the faculty as a nest of what they would have called fascists, was anybody who is where William Buckley is today was always dismissed as a fascist by the professors. And so he was, I will say, a remarkably tolerant, gave me extremely high grades, which must have caused him to wince. Hopkins in those days had a grade of H, which was above A+, and I got a lot of H's from him during the 2 years of a survey of philosophy. I don't think the word survey was used, and it was for juniors and seniors. It was not for freshmen and sophomores. But looking back on it, I realize it could have been called a survey of philosophy. And I did very, very well, which shows that he just gritted his teeth, apparently, and gave good grades to a conservative. So I have always had an affectionate place in my heart for Dr. Boas. By the way, it was customary when I was an undergrad to call the PhD, and 99% of the professors, of course, are PhDs, Dr. So-and-so. And then when I came back from the Army in 1960, it had gone to Mr. So in the 3 years when I was in the Army, apparently some word had been passed around Gilman Hall that it's to be assumed that all professors are doctors, and therefore to say D-O-C-T-O-R out loud was unsophisticated and superfluous. And so they were all misters, as at Harvard and various other la-di-da places. But nobody ever objected to doctor at that time, so he's always Dr. Boas. So I was extremely fond of him, immensely impressed, as a 20-year-old ought to have been impressed, by his intellect. And the political thing, the political contrast of views never had any effect at all. And I still revere his memory, regret that he was misguided. He was very fair to me and probably regretted that I was misguided. But he was an awesome character. By the way, he even looked the part of an intellectual. He was almost entirely bald, had a slight fringe of gray hair on the sides, around the ears, but very, very little. And though he was younger than I am now, which is hard to believe, he had a much more dignified appearance. I'm sure I look like a nobody, but he had a very impressive profile, and somehow the shape of his skull and his features were awe-inspiring. Nobody would ever have been moved to be flippant or frivolous or to say anything off-color around him. In private, he probably enjoyed off-color jokes, but I never found out about it. And he had though not very tall, he was not, I don't know, 5'7" or 5'8" maybe. He was not terribly tall, but he had a very majestic, a very impressive bearing. And I suppose I have copied his style more than anybody else's here at WNL, though there were other professors I liked very much, or came to like. The boredom somewhat faded as the 4 years of undergrad school went on. But Boas is by far the most awe-inspiring teacher, and I hate to use the word acquaintance. We were bare acquaintances. He was my advisor, but we never rambled and talked about his life or my life or politics, heaven knows. The business of registering and talking about course selections for the next semester were done in his office and in a rather short 5 or 10 minutes, and it was all very businesslike. So I guess the word acquaintance is permissible, but we were certainly not friends. But I suppose in my last moments of senile disintegration, I'll remember him more than most of the others, I would think.
That's quite a testimonial.
Well, thank you. He deserves every kind of testimonial. The one whose courses I enjoyed the most is still living today. I look for his name in the Washington Post obituaries daily, which he must be 90 in the shade now. Richard Hubbard Howland, H-O-W-L-A-N-D. And I think he was the head of the art history department. This is not art studio. We didn't do sketches of football players or anything like that. This was art history only. And I believe it was a two-man department in that period. And there was another very nice fellow named Christopher Gray, who was possibly the same age, I don't know. But Howland was the one who introduced me to the formal study of art history, which was by far my favorite topic at Hopkins, as you can imagine. And that also started with, maybe not with cave drawings, but except for one day, but ancient Egypt and Babylonia and so forth. And then We went through the Middle Ages, and I did actually manufacture in my own mind an interest in cathedral architecture, which now it seems less than thrilling to me. But the Renaissance and the Baroque period were by far my favorites. And that also was a two-year program of all of Western art history. This did not include the Orient or the Aztecs or the Incas, the European tradition in art. And Egypt was given credit for being the beginning of, even though it's not in Europe, it was the beginning, and then Assyria, and then we moved to Greece and Rome and stayed in Europe from that time on. And I just loved it. I became almost intoxicated with passion for architecture, sculpture, and painting. And Howland was a lively lecturer. Even though it was 9 a.m., which I hate, it's an hour I hate, but even though it was 9 a.m., I was never tempted to fall asleep. So anyone who can keep me awake at 9 a.m. is doing pretty well. There, I remember the class was taught in a room on the south side of Gilman Hall. The facade of Gilman Hall, if I remember, faces east. So the sides of the building are north and south facing. And this was on the south side, on probably the second floor, if you include that basement floor as the first floor, the ground floor. And I remember the room with great vividness because there was so much aesthetic stimulation there from the slides. It was a slide course, of course, on a big screen, and his lectures. And I remember I got there early of all things, maybe 8:45, 8:29, before anybody had showed up, and the room was unlocked. And I was just sort of posing around in the room, and I picked up the top of a Roman urn. It was square, not round, a Roman container of marble. And inside were the ashes, presumably, of an ancient Roman, some 1900 or 2000 year old urn. And now I think if I did that, I would swipe one of the little bone fragments, because the Romans cremated people, and rich people, God knows what they did to the poor folks, let's throw them in a pit probably.
This was in a classroom?
In a class, but it didn't look, there were seats arranged for a classroom, yeah, but all around the room were glass cases with various exhibits of an archaeological sort. Lots and lots of glass cases. So when you entered the room at first, you didn't realize it was a classroom. It looked more like an old-fashioned museum room. And then you would notice that there were seats for a normal-sized class. And I don't think he ever referred to these exhibits. Maybe graduate students, MA candidates were. There was no PhD program in art history, or I would have taken that. But there were MA candidates in art history. Maybe they did something with the things in the glass cases, or maybe Hopkins just wanted to show that people connected with Hopkins had done archaeology. It could have been that. But it is the only time in my life when I removed the lid of a Roman urn and found the actual remains inside. And that would stick in anyone's mind for half a century. That is not easily forgotten. And then Professor Howland later went on to head the National Trust for Historic Preservation in Washington. And he's certainly been retired for a great many years, and he's 85, he's got to be 85 or 90 now. But I remember his classes with extraordinary pleasure, because of the subject matter. And he was also a very nice man. And a bad teacher a bad teacher could have spoiled the subject matter, could have managed to make something interesting boring, and he certainly did not do that. Either because of the subject matter or because of him or both, I was in love with art history more than I can ever express right now. And I was very disappointed later on when graduate school time came that they that the university did not have a PhD program at that time. So those were three of the teachers whom I very much remember. Probably if I sat here for 20 minutes and just went over there was one interesting one. He later became my dissertation advisor. Hans Wilhelm Gatzke. Does that name ring a bell? G-A-T-Z-K-E. And he was born in 1915, died 1987. And he did in the second year of the freshman-sophomore survey what David Spring had done in the first year. Gotsky picked up the story of European history in 1715 and carried it up to the present. He was a German exile who had, a Gentile now, not Jewish. He had fled for political reasons, not racial or ethnic reasons, from Hitler's Germany around 37, I believe. He was a translator at the Olympic Games for the Canadian athletes in August of 1936. And he, after I got to know him, not at first, but he was kind of grand and aloof, though not very old. How old was he at that time? He was not quite 40 when I met him, a very spiffy dresser, very elegant, natty dresser, and obviously very conscious of his good looks. He could have played a Nazi colonel in a Hollywood movie, though he would not have wanted to because he was very anti-Nazi. But he told a story later about having been with the Canadian athletes, who didn't speak German, obviously, and he had studied English. And he did in the Olympic Stadium on the day when the torch was brought into the stadium. And while a lot of the people in the spectator stands were looking at Hitler, because Hitler was the best celebrity, not the nicest, but the most conspicuous celebrity in the world in 1936, and the Nazi Reich was putting out propaganda about all the wonderful achievements of the regime. So Professor Gotsky told me that during a good deal of that day's athletic events, people were staring at Hitler, people from other countries particularly who had never seen him, and Germans, of course, staring in adoration of the Führer. And the one time when most of the people were not looking at Hitler was when the Olympic torch was carried into the stadium, and Gotsky said he chose that moment to look over at Hitler's box where the dignitaries were seated. And he said Hitler apparently had come to the Olympic opening day ceremonies without a Kleenex or a handkerchief. And Hitler glanced around when the torch was brought in and satisfied himself that people were looking at the torch, and ran his jacket sleeve across his runny nose. And it's one of the few human moments with regard to Hitler that I've ever heard. But Gotsky did not have a sentimental or affectionate view of Hitler. He, of course, rightly regarded him as a monster. Mm-hmm. And Gotsky had come to the United States, I think, in 37, and had been taken up by the Bundy family of Harvard. And they had put him on the track to a PhD. But, of course, the Second World War came along rather soon. So Gotsky was in the U.S. Army. The Bundys saw to it that he got American citizenship very quickly. And then I think he came to Hopkins about 48 or 49. And years later, as I say, he was my dissertation advisor. But he was a very impressive man. He had sort of an aloof, regal way about him. And he was not a von. Had he been a German aristocrat, he would have had a V-O-N in his name, mm-hmm. Paul von Hindenburg. But I'm sure that he was of bourgeois origin. He was from the Rhineland. And he certainly had the snottiness and the sort of sneering way about him that an old-fashioned aristocrat would have. But I don't think his sneers were directed particularly to me. I think he just regarded the human race as a lot of Neanderthals, and he was the great Hans Wilhelm Gotsky on a pedestal. But he was a very helpful dissertation advisor and put no obstacles in my path. And, mm-hmm. accepted what I turned in, and I got good grades in the sophomore course, but that was the grades were determined, I think, by the section instructors. Mm-hmm. I think their Herr Professor lectured, and then the graduate student flunkies were the section, what they call TAs, teaching assistants. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether he ever read any of my exams, but ours was a long association.
Now, did you live on campus or at home?
No, thank heaven I was able to live at home. I'm very grateful that the university did not have a rule that all freshmen, wherever they were from would have to live in the dorm, because I was very attached to privacy and modesty and so forth, and so to live in a dorm would have been agony for me, and that was one of the things. I don't remember whether Loyola required that, living in a dorm, I can't remember. But I would have found it excruciatingly embarrassing to live day and night with somebody else. So yeah, I got on what was called the Crosstown Bus, the number 22 bus on University Parkway, and it went to Liberty Heights Avenue, and then there was a trolley car, I mean on rails, not a bus, a trolley car on rails, and then that went within maybe a mile of my house, and I walked home from there. And occasionally my father would come and pick me up.
Now, back in those days, what were the proportions? Were there a lot of town students? Or
I think so, yeah. I think there were a lot. I knew quite a few, but I really would be faking it if I tried to say 50-50 or 40% Baltimore or 60% out of town. I really don't know what the proportions were, but there was a very hefty local representation.
Was there a social distinction, and did the people who lived on campus interact with townies, or was there a social distinction, or how did things work?
I was so withdrawn from much social contact that I can't answer that in a very authoritative way, but it was not like Columbine High School, where apparently there were cliques and layers of people who were in, or students who were in, students who were out. It may be that I was just so, what is the word, self-centered, that I never gave it much thought. But I was never aware of any rudeness or any coldness or anything of the sort. I kind of suspect that the boys who were in fraternities, who were most likely out-of-towners, and there were a lot of fraternity houses on Calvert and on St. Paul Streets, maybe one or two on Charles Street, but it seemed to me they were on the next two streets. I, for some reason, think, I don't know how I'd footnote this, that the fraternity boys were the ones who were the most active in student government and the student newspaper and the debating society and activities of that sort. But I had no desire to mingle with people of my own age, male or female. I just didn't like people of my own age. I was more at home with adults. And so if I was snubbed, I certainly wasn't aware of it. And there were nobody ever was overtly rude or scornful or unpleasant. It was a very relaxed atmosphere. But I think they may have realized this guy is a loner, a townie, and a loner. Though the word townie, I'd never heard the word townie until I came to W&L. And then, of course, the students here refer to the local talent as townies.
Was there any term at Hopkins to make the distinction?
I guess they would have said guys from Baltimore, probably. But there was no slang term that I remember. And no animosity among groups. There were the Young Democrats and the Young Republicans, but there were never any shouting matches or insults being flung back and forth. It was an extraordinarily pacific and polite atmosphere. And some of them came from rich families and some from rather humble families, but it wasn't that everybody was from a prep school background. Starting with me, not everyone was from a prep school background. But affability, maybe that's not quite the word, but the cordial toleration of everybody, by everybody, seemed to be constant. And it was a very unstressful atmosphere. That is certainly a well-chosen, if I may say so, a well-chosen word. It was a peaceful and in no way a stressful atmosphere. And
I'm sure there were those who were very close and friendly, groups of three and four and five buddies perhaps, or a pair of buddies. But if there were cliques boxes within, I think of the Chinese boxes within boxes, I wasn't even aware of it. I just did the work, got on the bus and went home, unless I had arrived from David. On afternoons when the Republican Club met, if we had used the word conservative, I mean, there the faculty, I think, would have said, what next, swastikas? So we didn't dare use the word conservative, but we did use the Republican Club as sort of a vehicle of conservatism. And for what good it did, Eisenhower in those days was not regarded as a conservative. He had defeated a conservative for the Republican nomination in 1952. And so, of course, we regarded that as a liberal triumph and saw no difference between him and Adlai Stevenson, whom he had defeated. We thought of them as Tweedledum and Tweedledee. So I did chat with the young Republicans. Sometimes we'd go to the snack bar, a group of three or four young Republicans, but there was no sense of isolation or snubbing or being put in a cage of disgrace in, among the students. Everything was very laid back and very peaceful, and never that I saw any signs of hostility. Hopkins, of course, did not have a jock component, as presumably the University of Texas does, or the University of Maryland, I'm sure, takes football and things like that very seriously, basketball. But athletics didn't have any cachet, any particular standing at Hopkins. And there, lacrosse, certainly. But that the lacrosse program was kind of by itself, and Hopkins baseball, Hopkins football, other sports didn't seem to register. And so the lacrosse players probably palled around with each other, but they didn't yell insults at the rest of the students. And I'm only vaguely aware of who the lacrosse players were. And was at the time only vaguely aware. And maybe if the athletes had been, as they probably were at the College Park, Maryland campus of the U of M, maybe athletes there comprised a sort of sweaty aristocracy. But at Hopkins, that was not the case at all. Scholarship and study, taking studies seriously, was what counted. And I took grades very seriously. And actually got interested in some things, art history most notably. Mm-hmm. So no, I guess there was other students were probably aware of a wall between students, and between out-of-towners and townies, but I wasn't aware of it.
Now, one thing that I know Hopkins was a real pioneer about, and that a lot of local people did, was their evening school.
I knew nothing about it. Yeah, I do remember that there was something. In fact, a friend of mine, one of the few guys I got close to, was I'd known him in junior high and senior high, and then he came to Hopkins at the same time I did. So he and I talked quite a good deal. And later on, when I was in graduate school, I think he was drafted before I was. But he went to the Hopkins night school. His family had no money at all. And he later became a public school teacher. And he did go to the Hopkins night school in the mid-50s and left rather scornfully to me about the low quality of the teaching there, and said that he was taking an education course. He knew he would be a high school teacher, so he was taking courses that looked toward that. And I remember once in 1956 or 57, he was over at my house and told my parents and me, very disdainfully, that the quality of teaching was sub-zero at the night school, and that a teacher had asked the class, why do we have so few records today of ancient Athenian education? And the class offered up no answers, and the teacher said, because when Mount Vesuvius erupted and buried Athens, all the records were lost. And so that is my one and only recollection of a story about the Hopkins Night School.